Well, I've been asked to talk about China this afternoon and its relationship to these themes that we've been discussing from the standpoint of the Indian tradition. Suppose if you were to try to invent two peoples at opposite poles of any spectrum you chose, Chinese and Hindus would be perfectly good candidates for the opposition. It's possibly a matter of geography. It's possibly a matter of physical race. Think of the Indian world, the jungle and the heat and the vegetal emphasis in the environment, and then the Chinese in the realms of the deserts and the animal world and the background of nomadism and the hunt. The Indians loving wild, vast imaginations, and the Chinese very practically oriented. The problem, for example, that the translators faced in translating the Sanskrit Mahayana texts into Chinese was that there were hardly any Chinese words to fit the Sanskrit words, and the translations had to be made by men who had themselves duplicated the experiences intended and could bring forth a vocabulary. Now, the vocabulary that was used by the Chinese in translating the Buddhist texts from India was the vocabulary of Taoism. Taoism had already established its basic literature. Consequently, the quality of the thinking, the quality of the mood and all, became transformed. And yet, in a quite miraculous way, the main themes, the main sense, was communicated. This is one of the most remarkable and impressive phenomena in the field of cross-cultural relationships and translation, I think, in the history of the higher civilizations. Now, when we go back to the centuries and millenniums of origin, we find what I pointed out in my first talk, namely, that both India and China had received their high culture forms in the period of the Bronze Age civilizations from the Near East. In that sense, in the very origins, they are related. Both of them, as I pointed out, are isolated from other parts of the world, so that new influences came in slowly and could be assimilated. You never had, until the modern period, a massive invasion of new thoughts, new forms. As a result, when one studies Oriental thinking, although there are many, many inflections, and when we go from India to China, great transformations in mood and so on, one is always on familiar ground. The same themes come back. The main aims are intended. I think of it sometimes as a wonderful, various forest, but a forest of palm trees, all different kinds of palm. Whereas when you turn to the Western world, where you have the Near East and Europe in very close contact with each other, and peoples of various sort piling in, overthrowing others with great destruction and reconstruction, we come to quite contrary philosophical positions in juxtaposition. Not so in the Near East, in the Far East or in India. Now, the Bronze Age intrusion into India and establishment of the basic civilization, as I said, takes place about 2,500 BC. People at that time walked. They had their cattle trains and their covered wagons and came into the land and established mainly as peasants, pastoral people, and trading people. The Chinese foundation took place 1,000 years later. The Shang Dynasty, the first archaeologically demonstrable dynasty of China, is dated now 1523 to 1027 BC. The remains are very slight. Earlier than that, and the dating of this that I'm about to mention now is very obscure, earlier than that, there is a sudden appearance, perhaps 1800 BC, of painted pottery ware, beautiful pottery, some of the finest that has ever been produced anywhere, beautifully designed with great curves and labyrinths and so forth, bearing designs that are those which appeared earlier in the Danube area and in Iran. There's a very close connection between those areas and China. These are the wares known as the painted wares of early China. Then with Shang, there comes in bronze vessels, and this is the important symptom, the two-wheeled chariot drawn by two horses, which is used as a war weapon. Now this was invented by the Aryans in southern Europe around the 1800 BC period. And with that invention, there comes a very powerful horizontal direction in cultural relations. Before that, when people went from here to here, they walked. And they sort of dug into where they were. And you have in the history of mythology for those periods a history of gradual diffusion and very intimate relationship to the land. With the invention of the chariot, however, which was like, let's say the tank, an invincible instrument of war, you have these flying, raiding invasions, the horse also ridden, and consequently a man able to move at a great rate, and China being established in its civilization in this period bears very close relationships, consequently, in its culture bases to the areas from which the invasions came. Now, it's shortly after this period that the Aryans with their chariots are raiding into the Mediterranean world, the period of the Homeric Greeks, and it's just about that time that the Hebrew people from the Syro-Arabian desert zone are raiding into Canaan. This is the period of the Homeric Greeks, of the Joshuan Hebrews, you might say. That is the dawn period of China. It's a period of warcraft. It's a period of terrible invasions. It's a period of the annihilation of cities. Whereas the Indian period and founding period had been one rather of agriculture and established trading people, here we get a spirit of warcraft and political enterprise. And I would say that throughout the Chinese history, one has a sense of this emphasis on political aims, so that the themes, which in India moved into the dimensions of meditation and abstract experience, are always reconverted in China and focused back on the political field. The two great classic dynasties, or rather pre-classic dynasties, the dynasties of China that represent the evolution of Chinese civilization, are the Shang and the Zhou, Chou. The Shang, as I say, 1523 to 1027. The Zhou comes in then, conquering the Shang, about 1027, and until 772, exists in a kind of feudal order. But then following 772, when new raids are coming in from the Mongol wastes, there is a shift of the capital, and the beginning of a disintegration of the culture. And that disintegration reaches a high point at about the time of Confucius. Confucius dates from 552 to 478 BC. Something similar was happening in India at this time. Just at the time of the Chariot entry into China, we have the entry of the Aryans into India, also chariot warriors, and the dawn of what is known as the Vedic Age. The older Dravidian period is left behind. And this Vedic period lasts from about 1500 in pretty good style, as the Chinese does, for about 200 or 300 years. And then comes the warring state situation, which is recorded in the Mahabharata. By the time of the Buddha, India is in this condition of great disintegration. Now the Buddhist dates are 563 to 483 BC. He's an exact contemporary of Confucius. Both of them are facing the same problem, namely a culture world that has gone into chaos. And each is seeking the exit or the correction. And it's quite characteristic of the Indian approach that the exit was chosen. The Buddha go into the forest, achieve nirvana, balance, so that anything can happen and it's perfectly okay. There is a mood of pulling out here. Whereas Confucius was concerned to reconstruct just to make my geographical connections complete now, think of the classical world and about the time of the 6th century, late 7th and early 6th century, we have the emergence of Athens and the cities of the classic period in contention with each other. And you can take Aeschylus as the contemporary of the Buddha and Confucius in a world of contentions as well, with Persia smashing in and so forth and so on. And his dates, as I seem to remember, are something like 525 to 4, what would it be, 478 or something like that. He's a contemporary of these other men and is also facing this problem of a disintegrating and a fighting world. And his answer is the tragic mood, the tragic mode. Yes, all things pass, but we affirm them, and we can come to talking about this a little later on. I want to get this point settled first, that we have these two quite different temperaments when we turn from India to China, and although they are sharing a heritage that comes from the Bronze Age, it's going to be transformed into local modes in these two realms, and comparing Confucius with the Buddha, or comparing the quality and spirit of Shang with the quality and spirit of the Vedic Age, one gets a sense of this dramatic contrast. Now let me start in with something about the Shang people. The great discoveries of in Indian archaeology were made by the Swedes in the 20s and 30s of this century, and they are of two particularly important orders. One was the discovery of Peking man. Now this is a archaic race of the type of Pithecanthropus erectus, dating from about 500,000 BC. As to whether the present Chinese race has any relationship whatsoever to Pithecanthropus, there is still discussion. If there is a relationship, it's extremely remote. Who brought in the painted pottery wares that I mentioned before is also a question. Were these Mongoloid people or were they Caucasoid? As you probably know, there is a strain of Caucasoid people in the Far East, particularly in the island world. When you go to Japan and go to the north of Japan, you will find completely Caucasoid people, the Ainus. They are celebrated as the hairiest people in the world. An old Ainu looks very much like Leo Tolstoy. He has the same, there is some kind of racial connection here between the Slavic East European and these Ainus. When I was up there in Hokkaido at Shiraoi, their most available little village, I was up there with a lot of tourists, a lot of Japanese tourists, and there was this little Ainu woman, and they tattooed little blue mustaches, very natty mustaches on the women. And this little old girl had been telling us all about the ancient times of the Ainus, and I wanted her picture, and I took her picture, and I gave her a coin in thanks, and she took my hand and showed me her hand, and how we both had hair on our arms, and how they were both white, and all the Japanese went like this, and there it was. Here we were meeting through this Mongoloid interval. Now, this brings up an important problem. Where did the Mongols come from? There is a theory that assumes that they came from the north in southern stabs, wedging down between these two now separated parts of the Caucasoid races. The Mongoloid may be actually the latest of the races to have evolved. One theory is that during the ice ages, they were actually marooned in the north in an enclave with mountains of glaciers between them and the south, so there was no escape, so that it is a race biologically selected, you might say, to endure terrific cold. And if you've ever lived in Japan in the wintertime, you can certainly credit this theory. Little paper houses in terrific cold. At any rate, they do represent a later coming down, and that movement also moved eastward into the Americas. So the one finds when one studies the mythologies of the American Indians and of the Chinese world, also some of the art systems, astonishing parallels. And of course, in the Americas, they went down all the way to Cape Horn, where they arrived something like 6,600 B.C. There's a C-14 date for that. We have lost in China, however, all evidence, all but fragmentary evidence, of their early mythology, what it might have been. The beginnings of our knowledge of Chinese mythology comes with this Shang dynasty and the Shang tombs. Now, the Shang tombs are appalling. I mentioned in my first talk the tombs in Ur, ancient Sumer, where whole courts were buried alive with their monarchs. The number of people in the grave in such a situation would not be more than 100 or so. In Egypt, in this same period, they were burying hundreds of people in the tombs also to accompany the pharaohs. And the pharaohs had two tombs, their city tomb and their country tomb. So there were two great mansions of people who would go into these tombs alive. And this went on in Egypt, not only with in relation to the pharaohs, but also to provincial governors and so forth. For instance, in Nubia, there have been unearthed Egyptian tombs with buried multitudes in them for every little person. And then along with this also, we have the burial of the wife with the husband. That's a sort of minimal sacrifice, which is the city. And I talked about this and something of the symbology of this. Well, in China, the contents of tombs turned out to be something like 600 or 700 buried people. And then in the fill-in that's thrown in the tomb, another 100 or 200 skulls, including monkey skulls and animal skulls, with plenty of human skulls. So there was a good deal of show-off, you might say, in these burials. This continues the motif from the Near East of the identification of the court with the heavenly system, so that at the end of the eon, the whole universe dissolves and at the end of a rain, the whole court dissolves. It's an imitation of the theme of dissolution and re-emergence of universes. And this is the idea in the cosmology of the Chinese. It is a cosmology like that of the old Bronze Age everywhere, of rise and fall, and rise and fall, and light and darkness. And this is the basic image in that Chinese Dai Chi sign of the black and white forms meeting each other. I don't have a board here to show it, but I'm sure most of you know it. It's the sign that's taken over by, what is it, the North Pacific Railroad or something like that. It's a circle with two interlocking figures, one light and one dark. The light representing the masculine principle of heaven, which is light, hot, fiery, and the feminine principle of earth, which is moist, passive, cold. Here again we have a contrast with India. In India, the feminine principle is the activating principle, the Shakti, and the masculine principle is the passive one. As one will find in marriage very often, the husband just wants to be left alone. It's the wife who has all the active ideas to go to the theater, to change the furniture around, to do this, to do that. He just wants to be still. James Joyce plays on this in Finnegan's Wake, where he speaks of the husband as the sleeper, and the wife is whispering to him after they have become extinct in the tomb. She whispers to him of such and so and so, and wouldn't it be lovely to start the whole thing over again? And it is true, there you are in perfect peace, and this perfumed phenomenon goes rippling by, and something gets started. This is the Indian view, the woman as the activating principle. For instance, in the image of Vishnu, sleeping on the cosmic serpent, floating on the cosmic sea, dreaming his dream. What is it is activating his dream? Well, his spouse is Parvati, Lakshmi is massaging his leg. That's just the irritation that starts the old dream going. And what's the dream? Comes forth from him in the form of a lotus, which is she herself, because her other name is Padma, which means lotus. So she's starting things, and he's dreaming things, and what he's dreaming is the world of which we are the manifestations. In China, on the other hand, the female principle is regarded as the passive one, and the male as the activating one, and that's the pattern we have in Europe as well. In the northern peoples, then, we have the principle of the male as the activator, and the female as what is activated and fecundated. And in the Indian sphere, you have the opposite principle. And this leads to a totally different psychology with respect to the sexes and in the mythological realms as well. So much then for these Shang tombs, or rather that's not quite enough for the Shang tombs, because in them there were found the first evidences of Chinese writing. And what these evidences were a little bone, oracle bones with little inscriptions on them, oracle inscriptions. Here's the beginning of this practical emphasis of the Chinese, the oracles, which continues when you go to a Chinese restaurant. What today? What do you get? You get fortune cookies. It's exactly the same mentality from the Shang tombs of the 15th century BC to the Chinese chow mein chop suey restaurants of today. Now this is rather important because in the Zhou dynasty, the following dynasty, the only book we know from that dynasty is the I Ching, which is that wonderful book of oracles. Now the I Ching was translated into German by Richard Wilhelm, I don't know, it must have been about 40 years ago, and then a couple of American translators, principally Carrie Baines, translated it into English. It was published by the Bollingen Foundation about 30 years ago, and remained a kind of latent on the shelves until somebody asked Bob Dylan what books he read, and he said, "I don't read. The I Ching is enough for me." And the Bodleian Foundation has been unable to publish the book fast enough since that announcement. So what I'm to speak of now in relation to the I Ching, which gives us the main thought forms of this Chinese cosmic order, is something of quite contemporary moment. How anyone can enjoy himself by reading the I Ching is more than I can understand. But if you're in trouble and want to know what to do, whether to get up or sit down, you might turn to the I Ching. And you do this by casting dice or pennies or yarrow sticks. And according to what falls out, you draw either a single straight line or a broken line. Now, the straight line is symbolic of the masculine principle, and the broken line is symbolic of the female principle. Now, just suppose you were to draw two lines. Suppose you were to draw two straight masculine lines. You get a certain sense of what that would be, male-male energy, in Chinese terms of male representing warmth and heat and action. Then suppose you drew a broken line at the bottom and a straight full line at the top. There you'd have the female under the power of the male. That would be a different mood. It would represent a different order of life and everything else. Then suppose you reversed those and put the male line at the bottom and the female above that. That would be a different situation. Again, that would be more like the Indian situation. It would be quite different from the other order. And then suppose you drew two and two broken lines, one on top of the other. This would be quite different again. And in the Chinese way, the first two lines would represent great aggressive power. The second would represent what the Chinese would regard as the normal and proper order of the masculine to the feminine. Then you would have the reverse of that, and this would be associated with a kind of disintegration, a decadence, sort of Hellenistic kind of civilization. And finally, you would have just the passivity of people without any action, without any movement, like some of the destroyed and broken culture fragments that scatter the world. Now, what we have in the I Ching is a piling up of six lines that way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, in all the possible combinations. And when you cast your yarrow sticks, you draw those lines and see what you've got. And then you turn to the book where each of these hexagrams, as they're called, or six-lined figures, is elucidated. Now, the elucidations date from many different centuries. There is one order from perhaps pre-Confucian times. There's another set of elucidations attributed to Confucius, who probably had nothing to do with the book, actually. And then there are still other ones from later times. And by reading these, you decide whether you're going to stand up or sit down. The decision can be made for you. And you'll get such advice as this: the dragon of the north quarter is emerging from the waters. Stardust is falling. Then you work that out. Now, all of this is deeply mythological, actually. These are fragments of great myths. And the dragon does represent the energy power of the abyss, and stardust, the energy power of the heavens, and so forth. And you get from these descriptions, analyses in mythological terms, the implications of these lines. Now, in later Taoism, these two lines are translated into the two terms yang and yin. Yang meaning masculine, yin meaning feminine. We hear such introductory descriptions as this: raise a pagoda, not a pagoda, a canopy over you. Beneath the canopy there is shadow, and the presence is earth. Above it there is heat, and the presence is heaven. And all you have to do then is think what happens when you're in the sphere simply above the canopy or in the sphere below. Up there is warm, there's light, here it's moist, there's cold and so forth. This is the way earth and heaven work together. They are the prime cosmic representatives of the yang and yin. And man is between, destiny is between, history is between, uniting these two principles. Do you see how that is? There's the circle, and here are these two strange little forms, which look as though they were moving against each other. And they are moving against each other. Let's just think what these three situations represent. There's the light, that's energy, in Einstein's terminology, E. This is dark, that's mass, in Einstein's terminology, M. This is movement, in Einstein's terminology, C. You know the formula, E equals mc squared? That's the formula for splitting and bursting atoms. C is the speed of light, it's movement. Energy, mass, and movement. They have been reduced here to a geometrical formula. In Einstein, we have an algebraic formula. You can use Einstein's formula for splitting atoms, but you can't use it for solving your marriage problems. This can be used for solving marriage problems, political problems, or anything else. Now let me tell you how it works. Just think of a day when at noon the white, the light, the yang is on top. And then toward evening it goes down, and in evening the yin is on top. And certain things are possible when yang is on top that are not possible when yin is on top, and vice versa. Think of the year. Winter, yang is on top. Summer, yang, or the masculine yang is on top, and in winter, yin, the female principle. Think of an individual's lifetime. In youth, it's largely yang. In older age, it's largely yin. You don't try to pluck fruit in the springtime, and you don't plant your seeds in the fall. Things must be according to season. Now this can be carried a long, long way. Chinese politics is that of wait for the yin yang to roll. You abide your time. You don't violently force things. This Lao Tzu calls Wu Wei, which is often translated not doing anything. That's not what it means. It means not forcing anything. There's our sign, very nicely enlarged for us. In the yin, there is a dot of yang. In the yang, there is the dot of yin. That's why they can stay linked, related. That is the linking thing. And then you can get the sense of the movement here. And just wait. Just wait. This is working in China today. Mao Zedong has written essays on this, linking it to Marxist thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And he knows that these derive ultimately from the same old Bronze Age source. The Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis is linked to the old Bronze Age themes. Furthermore, we can think of this in terms of India. India isn't so good at geometrical things of this kind. It is best at personifications. And this is what in the mythology is symbolized in the male and female in union. What I was speaking of this morning, of the bodhisattva and his shakti in sexual embrace. In Tibet, this is called the yab-yum, where the male and female are embraced. Here is the male, here is the female. All you have to do is personify them, and you see where you are. So that here we have this austere, geometrical, desert mentality somewhat of the Chinese, and the vegetal, blooming, jungle mentality of the Indian, turning everything into sensual, wonderful personifications, and here everything reduced to this rather dry, understated theme, which nevertheless has identical implications. Now in the arts, everyone you look at, in his stage of life and in his personal character, represents a certain combination of yang and yin forces. And in the artworks, this is why the black and white is so wonderful in the Chinese pictures. In the artwork, the black and white really carries yang and yin senses. So that to look at a person and catch his yang yin quality, and then by the proportion of your black to white in the painting, render the same, you are, as it were, echoing something that's there, not only in the person's appearance, in the shape of the drawing, but also in the very impact of the black and white in the drawing. You're carrying the impact of that person's personality. Matt, hand it over. This vocabulary is the vocabulary of Taoism, which was taken by the Chinese as the vocabulary for the translation of Buddhism. And the Buddhism that went to China was the Mahayana, that of world affirmation, and it fits in with this very nicely. That's the most difficult thing I have to try to present, and so I thought I'd get it off my chest right away. This I Ching is a book that is said to date from the Zhou Dynasty. But as I say, the Zhou Dynasty disintegrates, and by Confucius' time there are over 500 contending states, and Confucius' aim is to put it all back together again. He is supposed to have edited the I Ching. Whether he did or not, this is highly questionable. What was Confucius's view? Confucianism is China. This is the main philosophy of traditional China. There is a sign in Chinese, just like, I don't know how to make this one. Just two marks like that, which look like a man without any arms or head, just the two legs. That means man. This sign reduced becomes something like that. And when you add two lines to it, it means two men. That simple statement, two persons, is the clue to Confucianism. The sense of rapport between two people is the prime virtue to be cultivated in Confucian thought. The Japanese for it is jin, which simply means man, human being. The Chinese is written J-E-N and pronounced R-E-N, ren. And this is the prime virtue. It is sometimes translated humanism. That's not what it is. It's just the rapport between two people. It's important to know, however, what the social relationships of these two people are. And Confucius's development of this is in terms of what he calls the five relationships. The relationship of monarch to subject, of husband to wife, of father to son, of elder brother to younger brother, and of friend to friend. These are the five relationships. Now, one must assume then that there is a fixed order of life which is not to change and which is to be interpreted and understood and rendered socially in traditional terms. In order to render things traditionally, one must know exactly what they are and what the tradition is. Confucius felt, or is said to have felt, that things were going wrong because people were not naming things correctly. And if you want to confuse a society, all you have to do is invert the names of things. This is something that's going on now in rampant style. His principal ordering suggestion was the correction of names, the finding of the right name of things, and then knowing what its true name is, acting in terms of the proprieties in relation to that name situation. Thus, the social proprieties become the carriers of the vehicles of the sentiment of human intercourse. He was not interested in the cosmos, he was interested in the human intercourse. Immediately following Confucius, I gave you his dates, comes Moti, or Mozi, M-O-T-I, or T-Z-U, either one. Moti rejected the idea of the five relationships. This was aristocratic. This was hierarchic. General, universal love was his principle. How was this love to be realized? Through military enforcement. Everybody is to love everybody else or else. And he was the leader of a kind of fascist stormtroop corps. And in the areas of his authority, everyone was to report to his social superior what was going on. Children reporting their parents, servants reporting their masters, under secretaries reporting to over secretaries, and so on. And the whole affair we know what this is. Confucius in the contemporary China has been pushed back, and Mozi has been brought forward. Mozi went, you might say, into the background for most of the centuries of China, but on occasion would come forth. China has had a horrendous history of very beautiful periods and then terrible dissolutions. And when you get the terrible dissolution side, the Mozi philosophy comes forward. There is one other philosophy that we usually don't associate with the Chinese, and that is the one known as the philosophy of the legalists. This was absolutely political and practical, and corresponds to what in India is called the Arthashastra, or the technique for winning. It is utterly ruthless, and was the philosophy that finally united China after the time of Confucius. Poor Confucius, with his mystical, sentimental notion that where there is a good man, there will be a good family. Where there is a good family, there will be a good village. Where there is a good village, there will be a good county. Where there is a good county, there will be a good state. As though virtue worked mystically like that, had to see his own state knocked down by an invading Mongol warrior, working under the sign of the Book of the Lord Shang. Read this and it will lift the hair on your head. Just to give you one little inkling, the saying that seems to me to epitomize the whole thing is, where there are good rulers, there is bad government. Where there are wicked rulers, there is good government. Another saying, he who is not ashamed to do what his enemy would be ashamed to do, has the advantage. This plus motes constitutes the traditional background of the Mozarteum system, with Marx equated with Lao Tzu. It's a traditional Chinese affair. Many people say, oh, ancient China is being wiped out and all. This is not so. This is a period of disintegration in China and strong hand reintegration. The first great reintegration was by the Emperor Shi Huangti, who founded the Chinese dynasty in the so-called Jin, the Qin dynasty, and founded the Empire of China. And we still call China the Qin, the China world. Now, following Shi Huangti, we come to the great golden age of the Han. Han China, about 212 BC to 220 AD, contemporary with ancient Rome. 100 BC, a Silk Road was actually opened between China and Rome. It went right across north of Tibet through those austere landscapes there, in through Chinese Turkestan to Syria and so forth, and a communication started back and forth. Meanwhile, from Rome, there were sailing craft. Romans were the first, apparently, to realize that you could sail back and forth across the Arabian Sea on the monsoons, and a strong Roman trade began to open up from Egypt through the Arabian Sea to southeast India. A Roman trading station was opened on the east coast of India, south of Madras, and Roman coins have been found in Vietnam. There was a complete communication now from east to west at this period. And it was along that road that the Chinese received Buddhism. Buddhism came in from northwest India along the Silk Route in the first century AD into China. The Emperor Wu Di had a dream, so the legend goes, that a golden man was coming from the west. And he sent a delegation out to meet the golden man. And it went up along the river, along the length of the Chinese wall, and then out into the deserts. And sure enough, here came two little monks with a white horse. And on the horse was a package of sutras, Mahayana, Sanskrit sutras, and a golden image of the Buddha, which must have been in the Greek or Roman Gandhara style, which was the style of that period. This delegation, 7 years after going out to meet the two little men, came back. It was a long trip from China along this road. They brought him back, and a monastery was established known as the White Horse Monastery. And there, the wonderful work of translation began, translating Sanskrit Mahayana texts into Chinese. This went on for 500 years. Much of what we know of Mahayana Buddhism comes only from Chinese and then and Tibetan texts. The Indian texts have been lost and have to be reconstructed, I imagine. Now, when you get a lot of scholars at work, all this work up here, you don't get the religious spirit very much. And so, also, you get a notion that by getting the correct word down and getting the translation down, you've done all there is to be done. Translation and the enactment of Buddhist rites became the main character of Buddhism in China for a while. The Han Dynasty collapses about 220 AD, and there's a period known as the Six Dynasties of confusion, and it's in that period of confusion that Buddhism sank into China. Confucius' aim had been to reconstruct society. It was not reconstructed in his sense. Confucianism was revived in the Han period simply as a means for examinations to establish bureaucrats. Confucianism is the basis for the old traditional bureaucracy. Every young man has to study the books attributed to Confucius and pass an examination. And with this you get a rise of young men from lower orders to higher orders, and a fall from higher to lower, and that they don't pass their exams. This is very different from the Indian idea of caste, where a person inherits his dharma because of his family tradition. In China, it's a situation of virtue. The individual comes up through his scholarly virtues. Let me just say, this reminds me of another theme that I hadn't brought forth. In the Chinese history books, the prehistoric histories, you have this situation at the end of every dynasty, traditional legendary dynasties. A great king, a virtuous emperor, has a stupid son, a wicked, vicious, sort of middle-class citizen, has a virtuous son. The king dismisses his own son and hands the dynasty over to the virtuous son of the low-caste person. This is quite Chinese in contrast to the Indian hanging on to family dynasties. The dynasties here represent virtue, and they represent the mandate of heaven. It is heaven that supports the monarch who is virtuous. Well, that at least is the theory, but we do know how the dynasties changed. It was rather by way of the Book of Shang, one shooting the other down. Now I want to say a word about Buddhism in China and what happened there. 520 AD, a legendary, or perhaps actually historical, Indian saint came to China. This was Bodhidharma. He noticed there that what people were interested in were the rituals of Buddhism, the chants of Buddhism, the translation of Buddhism, and this was not Buddhism. He sat for 8 years facing a wall. When he arrived, he went before the emperor. The emperor said, I have founded, and he named the number of monasteries. I'm supporting, and he named the number of monks and nuns. What merit have I gained? Bodhidharma answers, none. Then the emperor says, who is this impudent person talking to me? And Bodhidharma says, I do not know. Well, this didn't recommend him to the emperor. So he went across the river and, as the story goes, faced a wall for 8 years. The point was, Buddhism consists in meditation, finding the Bodhi principle within oneself, not in chanting, not in performing rites. The Chinese were greatly concerned with rites, following Confucius's advice, and let it be within you. Well, a Confucian scholar came to consult with Bodhidharma and stood beside him for some time. Bodhidharma was looking at the wall. Snow came down, Bodhidharma still looking at the wall. The man was getting no result whatsoever. So, in order to show that he was serious, he cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma. And this, of course, distracted Bodhidharma from his meditation, and he turned and said, what do you want? And the man said, I want you to set my soul at rest. And Bodhidharma says, produce your soul and I will set it at rest. And the answer was, I can't find my soul. And Bodhidharma says, leave it alone, it's at rest. This man became the second leader of this Zen or Chan Buddhism. Now the word Zen is a Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese word Chan, C-H apostrophe A-N, which is a Chinese pronunciation of the Sanskrit word dhyana, which is D-H-Y-A-N-A, which means contemplation. And Zen simply means achieving the mode of contemplation of the Mother Light, which I've been speaking about for the past two talks. That's all there is to it. Everything else must be a means to that. And if it gets involved in anything else, you're not following Zen or Chan or Jhana. Now, of course, this Chan or Zen became monasticized, monasteries, and monasteries always have rules and this kind of thing, and communications, symbols and allegories to communicate the message. Now the story is that a young, illiterate peasant boy whose father had died and who was supporting his mother by collecting wood and delivering wood one day, had to stand at the door while he heard within the recitation by someone of the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And he was immediately illuminated. That's the sutra that tells us that all form is formless, that void and form are one. He got the idea. And deciding then to become a monk, he went to the local Zen monastery and offered himself as a monk. The master, these masters, these roshis really know what they're looking at, knew that this was something, but he was illiterate. He couldn't participate in the rites and doings of the monastery, so he was given a job in the kitchen. He's a kitchen boy. The abbot comes to the time of retirement, and he wants to appoint his successor. And he offers a competition. The one who, in one poem of four lines, can write the key statement of what Buddhism is, will become the next abbot. There was a young genius there, whom everyone thought was going to be the one, and he wrote on the wall, "The body is the tree of illumination, the mind, the mirror, bright, reflecting the absolute. Keep the mirror clean so that it will always reflect the absolute." So this Huineng in the kitchen asks his friend in the kitchen to read him the poem. The friend reads it and he says, "Now you write this one. The body is not the Bodhi tree, the mind no mirror bright. Since nothing is in any sense, on what should what dust alight?" And that second poem is found on the wall when the monastery youths come down to have breakfast in the morning, and there's a great stir and so forth. And the abbot comes down and pretends to be infinitely angry, and he takes his slipper and erases the second saying. He knew who did it, all right. And then he sends for Huineng in the middle of the night, and he says, "Here is the bowl. Here is the robe, go away." Because what is going to happen to the monastic routines if everybody knows that this is it? This is a very puzzling thing. This is the end, really, of high Buddhism in Japan, in China. Huineng died 718. Within 100 years, a mad monarch arises who extinguishes the Buddhist sects in China. They revive after this, but it's a terrible business at the end of the 9th century. And following this, the high religion of China is no religion at all, really. It's Confucianism, Neo-Confucianism. By doing the things that you are normally doing, you are performing the work that is no work, in which is the meditation of Bodhidharma. So instead of sitting, we have moving around Buddhism now. This is the Zen Buddhism of China. Now when you read books today about Zen Buddhism, particularly Suzuki, you will have many anecdotes from the Zen Buddhist Chinese. All is in what you're doing. You ask the master, what is the Buddha? And he says, "Have you had your breakfast?" And you say, "Yes." He said, "Did you wash the dishes?" You may be puzzled by that. Then you go to Japan, and you go to a Zen center, Zen monastery, and you find everybody sitting, doing just what you've been led by Suzuki to expect they wouldn't be doing. And you find that Zen is associated with very strict meditation techniques, and not with walking around at all. Zen in Japan was the Buddhism of the samurai. It was the Buddhism of highly styled, very tense living, athletic austerities. Now, two types of athletic austerities can be thought of, one of the military life and the other of the ascetic monastic life. What do you see when you go into a Zen monastery in Japan? You see a shelf here and a shelf there, and people sitting on the shelf looking exactly like images of the Buddha, seated there with the back and just the right thing and so forth. And you see walking back and forth two men with big staffs over their shoulders. And anyone who in his meditation goes like this gets one of these staffs zing on the shoulder, and he is to say, you know, Arigato gozaimasu. Thank you very much, you're very gracious. It has a very strict kind of military tension. The other Buddhism in Japan that is most important today is Shinshu. And this is the Buddhism just of secular life. This is the Buddhism that's carrying what would be Zen Buddhism in Suzuki's text. What are you doing? What is the Buddha? Do you like the way you're lying there? This is all there is to it. When I went to my first tea ceremony, which was for me in Kyoto, I was very graciously given symbols that would let me know the difference between Shinshu and Zen. And I'm going to conclude this by giving you these. In the tea ceremony, it's a very strict affair. I mean, if you put the tea caddy down this way instead of that way, you have committed a fault that nobody can possibly tolerate. It's like going to meet the queen with your mud on your boots. It's a very strict form. Well, of course, the Westerner, the Gaijin, can do nothing but make mistakes, but this is tolerated. There I'm sitting. And the tea is served to me in two bowls. The tea is a powdered green tea that's put in the bowl, and then a steaming water is poured in, and then this is stirred up, and you drink this tea with three loud sips from the bowl, holding the bowl in a certain way. One bowl had been made in a Zen monastery. The other had been made by the Shinshu sect. Now, the Zen bowl was of very tense ceramic. It was a lovely fawn brown, and it was austere, tense, and you felt if I squeezed it, this thing would shatter. This is the quality of this Zen Buddhism. It's the Buddhism of art, of the artist, the highly trained artist, the Buddhism of the highly trained swordsman, the Buddhism of the highly trained virtuoso in meditation. The other bowl was a lovely, soft, thick bowl, a soft ceramic. It felt a little bit almost like a skin as you felt it. And it was a lovely pearl gray with a blue rim that had been allowed to drip down. You got a totally different feeling. It was that of relaxed life and the more homely virtues. And drinking these two teas from these two bowls, I got this message, which I'm trying to render to you, that Buddhism, in its ultimate modes in the Far East, whether in China or Japan, is the Buddhism of the life that you're leading. If it's the life of domestic life, well, have you washed the baby's diapers today? That is all Buddha action. If it is the life of tense, high-styled austerities, whether in the arts or in military life, it's there. And I told you the story a couple of talks ago of the samurai who, when his enemy spit in his face, sheathed his sword again, because that would have made him that had made him angry and was performing the act just as a impersonal being. So it is with all of these life acts, whether of domestic life or of the arts. In their terms, each is a rendition of the Buddha consciousness, provided you're aware of it. The main idea of Shinshu, which also comes from China, is that in doing your work, knowing that this is a Buddha act, one fine day in your deep unconscious, you will experience what is known as the awakening of faith. Not only will you know that you are operating in terms of Buddha consciousness, but you will experience it. That's the difference between mere knowledge and experience. That's the whole goal of this business. Well, following the rich flowering of Chinese culture in the Tang and Sung periods, I'd say from about 618 to about 1268, when the Mongols came in and smashed everything, following that, we have no further development of ideas in China. There is only a recombination of older ideas, and the ideas that become differently recombined in different periods are those of Confucius and the Jin, Lao Tzu, and the putting yourself in touch with the Tao, with the round, with the pace, with the rhythm of the universe, moving with that. The multi universal love system, the Book of the Lord Shang, that is to say, the ruthless political stroke, and finally, Buddhism in its two or three basic forms. One, that of devotion to a figure, to a Buddha. The one that's preferred is Amida or Amitabha, or one of the two ways of this living the Buddha life as Zen. So with that, I'll pause. It's gone over by time, and have some questions. What I'm expecting is more questions about Taoism, and that's why I didn't stress Taoism in the first part of my talk. So what is your question?
I wanted to ask you two. One about the yang and yin principle.
Right.
I had always felt that the Western concept of good versus evil, our whole view of duality, in the Oriental view, though it is duality, it's more an acceptance. A tolerance seems to be implied, because you can't say either of the two principles is evil. There is no good and evil. In equilibrium, they're both good. They're both essential. Do you think that there's an important difference there?
There's a very important difference between the whole mood of Western religious thinking and Eastern that is implied in what you've just said there. Our religions, based on those that have come to us from the Levant, are essentially ethical in tone. As I pointed out, it is your relationship to a social group that determines your relationship to God here. And God not being you is out there, and the relationship is necessary. And in society, ethics are important. Ethic is the social virtue. But in the Orient, the main drift of the symbologies and religious thinking is metaphysical. It is not ethical. Ethics are quite secondary. They have nothing to do with the religious life. They have to do with the social life, which is religiously supported, but the religion is antecedent to the social. So you can actually be wicked, you can be asocial, and participate in the religious revelation. Yang and yin have nothing to do with right and wrong, or good and evil. They have to do with energy and mass. And they are as indifferent ethically as those two. With respect to energy, plus, 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 in the atom bomb, a lot of people think that's bad. Well, it's bad only in terms that it's going to hurt you just as a thunderbolt might. It's not intrinsically evil. And so you find the tendency in these Oriental myths of conflict and so forth for the power that is the dragon power, or the one to be suppressed, not to be wiped out. but only put down and still operating. Do you see? But there are times when what is now put down should ultimately be on top, and then what now seems good becomes evil. The thing turns over. This is a point that Mao Zedong is making in his discussion of contrariety as his principal essay on this point, the principle of contrariety. I'm glad we come to this in this way. Does this answer your question adequately?
Yes, but you just brought up another, when you referred to the dragon principle as something to be put down. I had thought the dragon was always very good, imperial and representative of heaven and all good things, if we must use that term.
The dragon is representative of the active energy in the water principle. And the water principle can be found, the waters under the earth or the waters that come down from the clouds. And so you'll find these dragons swooping around in the air and also coming, zooming up out of the water. But you don't want the dragon in the home. You don't want him extinguished, you see. In our Western stories, they tend to kill dragons. They don't do that in the Eastern stories, do you see? The dragon, when the dragon power comes up and laughs and beats his belly as though it were a great big drum, that's like thunder, lots of thunder. Well, that's fine when you need rain, but you can have too much rain, too. This has to be balanced back by the principle of the mare, who represents in the dragon mare contrariety, the principle, you know, of a service on the good dry earth. The dragon is associated with the serpent principle. The serpent sheds its skin and so is reborn, and it has become the prime symbol, actually, of the reincarnating principle, that thing which survives death. It sheds its skin as the moon sheds its shadow, so it is associated with the moon principle. The moon dies, the death covers it, and then it sheds the shadow as the serpent sheds its skin. The moon reborn and the serpent reborn are equivalent symbols. The serpent represents the energy of the spirit bound to the earth. It moves like water. It is associated with the moon, which is associated with the tides, also with the woman's menstrual cycle, and with the whole business of life and creativity in life. Now, the contrary to the moon and the water is the sun and fire. The solar principle brings up water. The animal counterpart of the sun, that is the match to the serpent, is the eagle or hawk, which pounces on serpents. And that image of the hawk or eagle pouncing on the serpent is the image of the solar principle conquering the lunar principle, the fire principle burning up the waters. Now, the bird represents the free flight of the spirit. One flies through the sun door. The serpent represents, as I've said, the spirit bound to the earth, just as the moon represents the eternal coming and going of the bound spirit. The sun door is that burning gate through which the spirits of yogis pass beyond the sphere of lunar rebirth. The moon is supposed to be the realm in which the fathers dwell, who are to be reincarnated in their sons and grandsons. The sun is the sphere of the yogis who have cast off reincarnation altogether. This is the way these things are read in the popular mythologies of the ancient world. Now, in India, there is a very interesting image that comes up in connection with the funeral pyre. When you burn a body, you get flame and smoke. Is that person's spirit going to ride on the smoke or on the flame? If it rides on the flame, it goes to the sun through the sun door and will not return. If it goes on the smoke, it rides to the moon and is in the realm of the fathers and is reborn. So the image of immortal life has two entirely contrary meanings. It means a life being reborn, as the round of the moon suggests, or a life transcending rebirth, as the passage through the sun suggests. Now, the dragon principle is associated with the lunar power here, and the mare with the
solar power in a curious way. That fire is the fire of the third chakra, of which I was speaking this morning. And the moon is the dew from the upper chakras, of which I was speaking this morning. Now, when you get to China, this thing goes into a strange reverse, because the masculine principle is associated with the sun, and the feminine with the moon and the water. As a result, the dragon represents, as it were, the masculine energy in the sphere of waters, and the bear represents the feminine principle in the sphere of the sun.
Could you expand on the concept of Wu Wei dimension?
Yes, I do want to say more than I did say about Taoism. Lao Tzu is apparently surely a mythological character. It used to be thought that he was older than Confucius, and there are legends of the conversations between the old sage Lao Tzu and the younger sage Confucius. Actually, the Taoist development followed the Confucian period and belongs to the third centuries, the fourth and third centuries BC in China. The principal Taoist sage is Zhuangzi, Zhuangzi, who is a wonderful, wonderful person to read. Let me tell you one little story from Zhuangzi, and this gives the whole sense of the Tao. It's the story of the emperor of China staging a grand feast, and he noticed that the carver of the meats was wielding a great knife with great ease and carving the meats and sending them forth and so forth. And he approached the carver and he said, let me see this knife of yours. It must be a wonderful knife. And he notices how sharp it is and says, you must keep this very sharp. You must sharpen it every day. No, says the chef, or whatever we call him, I never sharpen the knife, and I received it from my father, and he never sharpened it, and he received it from his father. We never sharpen the knife. Well, said the emperor, doesn't striking the bone and striking the flesh of the meat dull the knife? No, he said, because we don't strike the bone, and we don't strike the meat. We cut the emptinesses between. You follow the order of nature. In the Chinese flood story, the Chinese flood is not quite like the biblical or Sumerian flood, where the whole universe is flooded over. It's just China that's flooded over. And there is a prime minister who's trying to solve the problem. And there was one prime minister named Lun who tried to dam up the waters. That's working against nature. So he was dismissed, and then the great Chinese floodmaster Yu comes along, and he dug channels to lead the water out. This is perfect Taoism. This is their business of following the round of the cycle, you see. You follow the course of nature. You don't resist it at all. You go with nature. Now, this order of nature is called the Tao. T-A-O, pronounced Tao, as though the T were a D. And the Tao simply means the way, the course. There is the Tao of the universe, there is the Tao of each of us, which is in accord with the universal Tao. Now, in Confucianism, the optimistic notion that the rapport between human beings can be cultivated and can become the guiding principle very often meets with frustration. There is a period of chaos and so forth, and then what does the Taoist do? He leaves the society, goes on the mountaintops, and does what we're all doing here, contemplates the sea, contemplates the sky, tries to put himself back in accord with the nature order, which is the prime order of our being. And out of that you may then bring forth a natural order. Taoism tends to be pacifist. There are paragraphs in Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching which say, where there is war, where there is strife, only destruction follows. The emperor must command, he must urge, but he must never compel. Wu Wei means non-forcing, going with it. You can determine how the thing is going to go. You can guide it and push it and urge it, but not against nature. When you feel that nature resistance, quit. You're out of tune. And the real sense of Taoism, I would say, is just in that. You can get the whole thing by reading those few little pages of the Tao Te Ching. And there you get, at the beginning, the word of mystery again. The Tao that can be named is not the ultimate Tao. This is that unnameable mystery. That which can be named is the mother and father polarity of earth and heaven. Taoism tends to be mother-oriented, earth-oriented, rather than heaven-oriented. Confucianism tends to heaven orientation. Then there's another saying in the Tao. Now, here's a very interesting thing in the Tao Te Ching. There's an aphorism, and I can't tell you the number of it. It's about 42 or 3, something like that, that says, that which can be named is not the true Tao. What is named is not the true Tao. Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. This is a precise quotation from the Kena Upanishad in India, which says, those who do not know, know. Those who know, do not know. Because to know is to be in error, and not to know is to be correct. This is exactly the same. The two just fit like that. This has led a number of other aspects of all this to the belief that in the 4th and 3rd centuries already, there were influences going into China from India, because this is news to China. You didn't have that before. Of course, with the opening of the old Silk Road, 1st century B.C., the connections are continuous from then on.
What was it you were saying about the Taoism really arose after the repression from the Chang Dynasty? Or the mythology, the later Taoism?
Taoism. I see what the question is about. The Taoism of the pre-Han or pre-Christian period, B.C. Period of China, is a philosophical Taoism, essentially. In the Dong period, which dates from 618 to 906 A.D., in the Dong period, the Buddhist monastery forms and life influenced the Chinese, and there was a kind of parody or imitation of this in Taoist terms. So you have the rise of a Taoist church, actually, with a priesthood and a pantheon. This Taoist pantheon is a very strange pantheon. It's a folk pantheon put together of all kinds of miscellaneous deities from the folk traditions, arranged in a hieratic fashion that somewhat duplicates the Buddhist. And then in this period of the late Dong, in the 9th century, it was through the influence of the Dong priesthood that this persecution of the Buddhists, not only the Buddhists, but also the Manichaeans and the Nestorian Christians took place. So these are two entirely different things. The philosophical Taoism of the Zhuangzi and Laozi time, and the later, you know, Jostic Taoism that you find when you go into a Taoist temple now.
Jess, it's kind of a general question. I don't know if Jung said it, but I know a lot of Jungians say it, which is a different thing, really. Right. But a lot of Jungians assert that in going after a mythology, not your personal one, but also in relationship to a collective mythology or as evidence in a religion or whatever, it feels much more important for a Westerner to stay with the Western mythology and for the Easterner to stay with the Eastern mythology. And I just wondered what your feeling on that was. And the Jungians, well, do you understand or do you know?
Yes, I understand. I go with that entirely. I think, however, that many of our Western symbols are can be interpreted most successfully by comparison with either Oriental or primitive symbols. You begin to see what this is what I propose to try to do in the latter part of our week together. There are certain themes that are better elucidated in Oriental lore than in Western. If you read, for instance, Jung's introduction to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Wences' translation, he states there that in research into the unconscious, the Oriental thinkers are centuries ahead of the Western. And he states that he has himself been enormously influenced by the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I know also that he was personally a friend and a very close friend of both Heinrich Zimmer, who was the great Indologist, and Richard Wilhelm, who was the great Sinologist, and he took a great deal from them. His whole development of the idea of the mandala, the sacred circle, which enables you to compose the scattered elements of your own psychic commitments, he took over from those two men. It was Heinrich Zimmer's work called Kunstform and Yoga, the art form and yoga, the relationship of the Indian arts to yoga, that introduced him really to these things. However, when Jung was in India, he stayed on the boat instead of going to meet Sri Ramana Maharshi. It was a load that he didn't want to assimilate. We have developed, and it is the great dignity of our whole culture heritage, the ego principle. Respect for personality, respect for individuality, but also respect for that organ of the psyche which puts you in touch with present empirical circumstance and invites you to evaluate it yourself, not in terms of what you've been told. Whereas the whole Oriental tradition, no matter what one you turn to, has to do with the suppression of individual idiosyncrasies. You fulfill the role, what Jung calls the persona, the mask, the offered role which the society presents to you. You are to take seriously, to identify yourself with, and you are not asked, what kind of ice cream do you want today, Johnny? You see, we from the time we are little youngsters have been asked to criticize, to decide, to develop this function. Now in the Orient, ego, what Freud calls the reality function, is not distinguished from id. I and mine is what is associated with ego in the Orient. And they're continually cutting ego down, cutting it out. So that when the individual develops to the stage, let's say, of middle life and embarks on the adventure of the forest, of the yoga, there is almost no ego there to be smashed. Whereas when a Westerner who has spent his whole life cultivating and appreciating the values of personal judgment, self-responsible action, is confronted with these techniques of ego destruction, there's too much ego there to be destroyed. You take bump after bump after bump, and it's still there. I've known more utterly frustrated Westerners who've been practicing all these yogic exercises, and there's the old ego, and there's no illumination. It just didn't smash. It's like trying to smash a boulder with a tack hammer to do this. And the fact is that way deep down in you, as a result of our education and our appreciation of what the results of this education have been, we don't want to lose that faculty. The closest thing to it would be the disciplines in a Trappist monastery. But even there, they are adapted to a totally different kind of psychological structure. I think there's something rather grotesque, actually, about the Western Caucasian parading around as a Hindu. You know that this somehow is not working. And I've been interested in this for, well, I can date it for over 40 years. And I've known many people who have gone very seriously into this, and I know I can't name more than one or two that have had anything like a convincing life out of pretending to be Orientals. You can't put on someone else's hat. You've got to bring the God, if God is what you want, you've got to bring the life out of your own existence, and this is another existence. Well, it's now that sacred hour of seven again. thanking you all.